Dawn of Flame by Stanley G. Weinbaum. Chapter 1. The World. Hull Tarvish looked backward but once, and that only as he reached the elbow of the road. The sprawling little stone cottage that had been home was visible as he had seen it 1,000 times, framed under the cedars. His mother still watched him, and two of his younger brothers stood staring down the mountainside at him. He raised his hand in farewell, then dropped it as he realized that none of them saw him now. His mother had turned indifferently to the door, and the two youngsters had spied a rabbit. He faced about and strode away, down the slope out of Ozarky. He passed the place where the great steel road of the ancients had been, now only two rusty streaks and a row of decayed logs. Beside it was the mossy heap of stones that had been an ancient structure in the days before the dark centuries, when Ozarky had been a part of the old state of Missouri. The mountain people still sought out the place for squared stones to use in building, but the tough metal of the steel road itself was too stubborn for their use, and the rails had rusted quietly these 300 years. That much Hall Tarvish knew, for they were things still spoken of at night around the fireplace. They had been mighty sorcerers, those ancients. Their steel roads went everywhere, and everywhere were the ruins of their towns, built, it was said, by a magic that lifted weights. Down in the valley, he knew, men were still seeking that magic. Once a rider had stayed by night at the Tarvish home, a little man who said that in the far south the secret had been found. But nobody ever heard any more of it. So Hall whistled to himself, shifted the rag bag on his shoulder, set the bow more comfortably on his mighty back, and trudged on. That was why he himself was seeking the valley. He wanted to see what the world was like. He had always been a restless sort, not at all like the other 6 Tarvish sons, nor like the 3 Tarvish daughters. They were true mountaineers, the sons great hunters, and the daughters stolid and industrious. Not Hall, however. He was neither lazy like his brothers, nor stolid like his sisters, but restless, curious, dreamy. So he whistled his way into the world, and was happy. At evening he stopped at the Hobel cottage on the edge of the mountains. Away before him stretched the plain, and in the darkening distance was visible the church spire of Norse. That was a village. Hall had never seen a village, or no more of it than this same distant steeple, shaped like a straight white pine. But he had heard all about Norse, because the mountaineers occasionally went down there to buy powder and ball for their rifles, those of them who had rifles. Hall had only a bow. He didn't see the use of guns. Powder and ball cost money, but an arrow did the same work for nothing, and that without scaring all the game a mile away. Morning he bade goodbye to the Hobels, who thought him, as they always had, a little crazy, and set off. His powerful brown bare legs flashed under his ragged trousers. His bare feet made a pleasant swoosh in the dust of the road. The June sun beat warm on his right cheek. He was happy. There never was a pleasanter world than this. So he grinned and whistled and spat carefully into the dust, remembering that it was bad luck to spit toward the sun. He was bound for adventure. Adventure came. Hall had come down to the plain now, where the trees were taller than the scrub of the hill country, and where the occasional farms were broader, well-tilled, more prosperous. The trail had become a wagon road, and here it cut and angled between 2 lines of forest. And unexpectedly a man, no, 2 men, rose from a log at the roadside and approached Hall. He watched them. One was tall and light-haired as himself, but without his mighty frame, and the other was a head shorter and dark. Valley people, surely, for the dark one had a stubby pistol at his belt, wooden-stocked like those of the ancients, and the tall man's bow was of glittering spring steel. "Ho, mountainy," said the dark one, "where going?"
"Norse," answered Hall shortly.
"What's in the bag?"
"My tongue," snapped the youth.
"Easy there," grunted the light man. "No offense, mountainy.
We're just curious. That's a good knife you got. I'll trade it.
For what? For lead in your craw, growled the Dark One.
Suddenly the blunt pistol was in his hand.
Pass it over, and the bag too.
Hall scowled from one to the other. At last he shrugged, and moved as if to lift his bag from his shoulders. And then, swift as the thrust of a striking diamond back, his left foot shot forward, catching the Dark One squarely in the pit of his stomach, with the might of Hall's muscle and weight behind it. The man had breath for a low grunt. He doubled and fell, while his weapon spun a dozen feet away into the dust. The Light One sprang for it, but Hall caught him with a great arm about his throat, wrenched twice, and the brief fight was over. He swung placidly on towards Norse, with a blunt revolver primed and capped at his hip, a glistening spring-steel bow on his shoulder, and 22 bright tubular steel arrows in his quiver. He topped a little rise, and the town lay before him. He stared. 100 houses at least. Must be 500 people in the town. More people than he'd ever seen in his life altogether. He strode eagerly on, goggling at the church that towered high as a tall tree, at the windows of bits of glass salvaged from ancient ruins and carefully pieced together, at the tavern with its swinging emblem of an unbelievably fat man holding a mammoth mug. He stared at the houses, some of them with shops before them, and at the people, most of them shod in leather. He himself attracted little attention. Norse was used to the mountainies, and only a girl or two turned appraising eyes towards his mighty figure. That made him uncomfortable, however. The girls of the mountains giggled and blushed, but never at that age did they stare at a man. So he gazed defiantly back, letting his eyes wander from their bonnets to the billowing skirts above their leather strap sandals. And they laughed and passed on. Hall didn't care for Norse, he decided. As the sun set, the houses loomed too close, as if they'd stifle him, so he set out into the countryside to sleep. The remains of an ancient town bordered the village, with its spectral walls crumbling against the west. There were ghosts there, of course, so he walked farther, found a wooded spot, and lay down, putting his bow and the steel arrows into his bag against the rusting effect of night dew. Then he tied the bag about his bare feet and legs, sprawled comfortably, and slept with his hand on the pistol grip. Of course there were no animals to fear in these woods, say wolves, and they never attacked humans during the warm parts of the year. But there were men, and they bound themselves by no such seasonal laws. He awoke dewy wet. The sun shot golden lances through the trees, and he was ravenously hungry. He ate the last of his mother's brown bread from his bag, now crumbled by his feet, and then strode out to the road. There was a wagon creaking there, plodding northward. The bearded, kindly man in it was glad enough to have him ride for company.
"Mountainy?"
"Yes."
"Bound where?"
"The world," said Hall.
"Well," observed the other, "it's a big place, and all I've seen of it, much like this. All except St. Louis. That's a city. Yes, that's a city. Been there?"
"No."
"It's got," said the farmer impressively, 20,000 people in it. Maybe more. And they got ruins there, the biggest you ever saw. Bridges, buildings. 4 or 5 times as high as the Norse church, and at that they're fallen down. The devil knows how high they used to be in the old days."
"Who lived in them?" asked Hall.
"Don't know. Who'd want to live so high up it'd take a full morning to climb there? Unless it was magic. I don't hold much with magic, but they do say the old people knew how to fly."
Hall tried to imagine this. For a while there was silence, save for the slow clump of the horse's hooves.
"I don't believe it," he said at last.
"Nor I.
But did you hear what they're saying in Norse?"
"I didn't hear anything."
"They say," said the farmer, "that Joaquin Smith is going to march again."
"Joaquin Smith?"
"Yeah. Even the mountainies know about him, eh?" "Who doesn't?" returned Hall. "Then they'll be fighting in the south, I guess. I have a notion to go south."
"Why?"
"I like fighting," said Hall simply.
"Fair answer," said the farmer. "But from what folks say, there's not much fighting when the master marches. He has a spell. There's great sorcery in New Orleans, from the merest warlock up to Martin Sayre, who's the blood son of the devil himself, or so they say. I'd like to see his sorcery against the mountaineer's arrow and ball," said Halls grimly. "There's none of us can't spot either eye at 1,000 paces using rifle, or 200 with arrow."
"No doubt. But what if powder flames and guns fire themselves before he's even across the horizon? They say he has a spell for that. He or Black Margot."
"Black Margot?"
"The princess, his half-sister. The dark witch who rides beside him, the Princess Margaret."
"Oh, but why Black Margot?"
The farmer shrugged.
"Who knows? It's what her enemies call her."
"Then so I call her," said Hall.
"Well, I don't know," said the other. "Makes small difference to me whether I pay taxes to New Orleans or to gruff old Marcus Ormiston, who's Eldark of Ormiston Village there."
He flicked his whip toward the distance ahead, where Hall now descried houses and the flash of a little river.
"I've sold produce in towns within the Empire, and the people of them seemed as happy as ourselves, no more, no less."
"There is a difference, though. It's freedom."
"Merely a word, my friend. They plow, they sow, they reap, just as we do. They hunt, they fish, they fight. And as for freedom, are they less free with a warlock to rule them than I with a wizened fool?"
"The mountaineers pay taxes to no one.
And no one builds them roads, nor digs them public wells. Where you pay little, you get less, and I will say that the roads within the Empire are better than ours."
"Better than this?" asked Hall, staring at the dusty width of the highway.
"Far better. Near Memphis Town is a road of solid rock, which they spread soft through some magic, and let harden, so there is neither mud nor dust."
Hall mused over this. "The master," he burst out suddenly. "Is he really immortal?"
The other shrugged. "How can I say? There are great sorcerers in the Southlands, and the greatest of them is Martin Sayre. But I do know this, that I have seen 62 years, and as far back as memory goes, here was always Joaquin Smith in the South, and always an empire gobbling cities as a hare gobbles carrots. When I was young, it was far away. Now it reaches close at hand. That is all the difference. Men talked of the beauty of Black Margot then as they do now, and of the wizardry of Martin Sayre."
Hall made no answer, for Ormiston was at hand. The village was much like Norse, save that it huddled among low hills, on the crest of some of which loomed ancient ruins. At the near side, his companion halted, and Hall thanked him as he leaped to the ground.
"Where to?" asked the farmer.
Hall thought a moment.
"Siloui," he said. "Well, it's 100 miles, but there'll be many to ride you."
"I have my own feet," said the youth.
He spun suddenly about at a voice across the road.
"Ha! Mountainy!"
It was a girl. A very pretty girl, slim-waisted, copper-haired, blue-eyed, standing at the gate before a large stone house.
"Hi," she called. "Will you work for your dinner?"
Hall was ravenous again.
"Gladly," he cried.
The voice of the farmer sounded behind him.
"It's Vale Ormiston, the daughter of Eldark's daughter. Hold her for a full meal, Mountainy. My taxes are paying for it."
But Vale Ormiston was above much converse with a wandering mountain man. She surveyed his mighty form approvingly, showed him the logs he was to quarter, then disappeared into the house.
If perchance she peeped out through the clearest of the ancient glass fragments that formed the window, and if she watched the flexing muscles of his great bare arms as he swung the axe, well, he was unaware of it. So it happened that afternoon found him trudging towards St. Louis with a hearty meal inside him and 3 silver dimes in his pocket, ancient money, with the striding figure of the woman all but worn away. He was richer than when he had set out by those coins, by the blunt pistol at his hip, by the shiny steel bow and arrows, and by the memory of the copper hair and blue eyes of Vale Ormiston. End of chapter 1.